Session number 12938, William Dunn, Reel 1.
Whereabouts were you born, please?
Ryhope in Sunderland.
Which year was that?
1923.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a miner.
Did you go to school in Ryhope?
Yes, I went in school at Ryhope.
And how old were you when you left?
14.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I went straight into the mines. 14.
And this was in the war?
No, 1937.
What happened to you when war broke out?
Well, when the war broke out, I worked at Silksworth Colliery, and when the war broke out, this colliery closed down because they were supplying France with the coal from this particular mine, and that with the war breaking out, they couldn't get the coal across there, so they closed this colliery down. And we had to go away to work, and I went down to Chester to work. And I was called up into the army from Chester.
What kind of work did you do in Chester?
We were working on a big oil refinery, building blast walls around the tanks, the gas tanks and the petrol tanks, for the bombing and things like this, in case of blast, and to shield the tanks. And I worked down there until I was called up into the army.
When were you called up?
January 1942 was when I went into the army. I got my papers the year before, like, a few months before. Like.
How did you feel about being called up?
I didn't mind. Because actually I thought the army was a lazy life to what I'd been used to. And I got into the forces, you know. And, I thought it was very easy going. And I thought, when we went into the army, I was always told by my father was in the army, First War, and he always said, well, you've got to make the best of it when you're in. So that's what I went in with, to try and make the best of it. And I thought, well, we may as well do it. We've got to live there and we've got to work together.
So you thought that it wasn't such hard work?
No, I didn't think it was hard work.
How were you treated in the basic training?
It was a bit rough at first, but once you got settled into it, it was really enjoyable, because you thought you were fit when you went in the army, but you weren't really till you started doing the route marches and physical training in the army. And then we knew what fitness really was. You know, because we played football and things like this, and this is where I started my football before I went into the army, but I carried on there when I went into the army, and I played football there and kept us fit there.
So even somebody who'd been a miner found it rough when they first went into the army?
At first, yes. The physical side, the fit, physical fitness, I mean, we all thought for all of being down the mine and things like this that you thought you were physically fit, which you were to a certain degree, I suppose, against some of the lads that came out of office work and went into the army. I think they felt it worse or more so than what I did. But I still felt it quite a bit, though. But, 'cause some of them was dropping out at the first sign of a route march, you know. But it didn't do so bad.
Which unit did you go into? Because you told me that you went into four old.
Yes, I went into the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry first. In just outside of York, Strensel Army Camp. And we did our basic training there. And we did quite a bit there. And then I went from there and we were transferred to the 70th Battalion of the Essex Regiment down in Epping. And then we started to do other types of work because it was a different infantry, different type of infantry, really, because the Coileys, or King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, was 120 to the minute marching. And then when you went in the Essex Regiment, it was only about 80 or 90 to the minute, you know, marching, which was a big difference. While I was at the Essex Regiment, I did commando training, went up to Fort William with the commandos, and did our commando training there. I carried on playing football down there with the army, so I didn't do so bad there. And then they decided that the 70th Battalion of the Essex Regiment had to be disbanded. So the, when it was disbanded, we had to, all had to go for these tests that they have in the army, putting squares and round holes and things like this. And they decided that I should be going to the tanks.
Royal Tank Regiment?
No, went to the Royal Armoured Corps up at Catterick for training there. And we had the trainers on all different types of tanks. And they decided that I would be a driver mechanic, which I had to go for trade tests and things like this for as a driver mechanic, which I've got the papers in my paperbook, so I passed the tests. And we did quite a lot of training there with the tanks there. And then they put me onto Churchill's, driving the Churchill's.
What was it like driving the Churchill tank?
Bit noisy. They're very heavy, and it was fairly easy really to drive a Churchill, because they're the only vehicle that's ever been known, as far as I know, that where you could get into the without starting the engine, you could turn the tank on its own circumference. The type of gearbox it had, you could just touch it. This is what you had to be very careful of when the tanks was in line, you know, along when people got in. You had to make sure that there was nobody standing alongside the tank when you got in case you caught the bar with your knees. It would swing the tank and jam them in between two tanks if you weren't careful. But it was fairly easy to handle, really, for the size of it. It was a 40-ton tank, and it's fairly easy to handle.
Can you remember the sequence of things that you do in going into a Churchill tank as a driver?
Well, you all stood in front of the tank, all the crew stood in front of the tank until you got the order to mount. And each, wherever you were placed in the tank, like me, my driver's had to drop in from the driver's hatch in the front, drop straight down into my seat. Make sure you didn't catch the bars with your knees. Make sure that everybody else was in the tank. And then you waited then until you got the order. Or what you know, whatever the exercise was that particular day, what you're going to do. Then you had to check all your instruments, make sure everything was okay, and then you got the order to start up with the engine, and you start the engine up, and then move off wherever you were going to, whether it was target practice or whether it was just exercises with the infantry and things like this. It depended on what was happening that particular day.
And you used to have to be able to do on-the-spot repairs?
Yes. And every man was trained in the tank to do the job of another crewman. So whatever, if there was a crewman injured or anything like that, another man could drop in and do his job. If you were out, say the tank was on its own, the radio operator got hit. Any one of the crew could take over the radio. And I had a co-driver sitting alongside me that if I got hit, he could take over. So we were all could do each other's jobs, you know, which was a good thing.
Did you know much about the quality of the German tank and anti-tank opposition?
Well, we got some good ideas about it. We were all trained and saw photographs and recognition and off tanks at different tanks they had, and we were told about the Tiger tank having so much armour in front of it, and we had to fire the guns at the Tiger or any other German tank for penetration purposes or to knock them out. And then we went, after my training was done in the Armoured Corps, they decided we were going to go abroad. To go to North Africa, and then they decided that they wanted to form this special unit for the Royal Engineers. So there was 26 drivers taken out of our lot to go to join the Royal Engineers, and we had to train the Royal Engineers on tanks, and they had to train us on the engineer side of it, and this is how the 2-6 assault squadrons was formed. And there was, I think there was about 8 or 10 assault squadrons was formed at that particular period of time. And I was in the 2-6, we went in the 2-6 assault squadron, and then the 77th and the 88th, and there was quite a few more. Because during the war, they were named as the funnies, because the different things that they carried. My tank, when I went to them, we were trained to carry the bassoon. There was others carried the bridges, flamethrowers, flails, and this type of thing, you know.
So when you enter the Royal Engineers, what did the sappers teach you?
Well, we were taught how they did the Bailey bridges, and there are different types of work, the explosive side, how they used the snake and things like that in minefields, how to put the barbed wire out, you know, in around the fences, and things like this. So that they were teach us quite a bit, but our main concern was the tank itself, and trying to teach them how to drive and how to use the tank, how the best benefit was for their jobs as well.
Where did all this take place, the mutual training?
Norfolk, no, Lincoln, Lincolnshire, in the Lincolnshire area, when we joined them at first.
And you were to be a fascine specialist?
Yes, well, that's what they decided, that my tank would carry this fascine when we had to go into action. But before that, our training was for the fascine. For all we trained with other things, the main thing was the fascine for our tank. And the other tanks, you know, they had the bridges and things like this on.
Was it just called the fascine tank?
No, it was just called the Avery, which was the armoured vehicle Royal Engineers. And they were all classed as it was just an Avery, and they could convert it to either, you know, whatever you were having, whatever you were doing.
What did the fascines look like?
It was a big bundle of paling, which is approximately, I would say, 15 to 20 feet across. Tightly bound up into a big round bundle. And the idea of it was, it was on your tank, on the front of the tank, was pulled up by horses, two horses come over the top of the tank and held it in place just above the turret. And when you got to whatever you go into, it was to drop into a ditch. So that when you came to these ditches, you could release it from the turret, the commander could release it. And you should drop down into the ditch, so he could just run straight over the top of it. So it was just more or less carrying on the road without stopping. And this was the idea, that you should run straight across and left it there, the other tanks could follow on. Because it was pretty strong, carry the weight of the tank all right, and the other tanks could follow you on. It was just as good as putting a bridge down, really. Only the bridges was kept for a wider ditch to what the bassoon was.
Were there any snags about using the Averys for scenes?
At first there was. like everything else that's new, you know, they tried different things and they tried different cradles to put on the front of the tank to hold it. The first ones they put on, they had the angle wrong, and instead of the tank, the bassoon rolling off when the horses was released, it just stopped there. It just stuck, and when we started to come back onto the tank instead of going forward. They overcome quite a lot of things. There's a lot of different things where they experimented with. Because while we were driving the Churchills, they experimented with quite a lot of things. They tried the Churchill with naval guns on and different things like this, you know, to try and find which was the best armour, the best way to adapt the Churchill for different actions. Had quite a bit of experience actually with Churchills before I joined the Royal Engineers, just experimental department. They tried different things on the chassis of the Churchill, you know. It's quite exciting really, in some ways.
Did you think the Churchill was a good tank for the time?
For the job it was meant for. You see, Churchill tank was basically an infantry tank to drive alongside the infantry. And to help them. And for that job, it was a good tank. And I think it was a good tank for the Royal Engineers for the job they had to do. For the flails and the bassoon and the bridges. Because it was ideal for weight. A 40-ton tank could carry the weight of the bridges and things like this. But if you got any lighter tank, it was going to be a problem.
So what kind of cradle turned out to be most suitable?
They put a metal frame on, metal cradle at the eventually, and it was very small to what you would expect, but it did the job perfectly because the angle of it was exactly right, so that when it was released by the tank commander, it rolled straight off to where you wanted it. Of course, the first ones, as I say, the cradle, wood cradle, some of them twisted. And instead of going straight in front of where you wanted it to be, they were going off at an angle. And you had a problem then to drive the tank round to try and pick up where it was.
Can you tell me about the lead-up to D-Day as it affected you personally?
Well, we knew about approximately 4 weeks before D-Day that D-Day was coming up. We knew exactly what we had to do, and we were told near enough the date that D-Day was going to happen, because we were put into a concentration area, which was Fort Goma at Leon Solent, just off Leon Solent. And they had barbed wire and wire fencing right round us, and we weren't allowed out. Weren't allowed out of the camp, and weren't allowed to write letters or anything like that. And we did training there, because they knew exactly where we were going to land, and we were shown on, not maps, but we were shown on the ground. And what they did, they put built scenes of how it was going to happen. And the culvert, we knew about the culvert, where we had to drop the bassine in, and how far it was off the beach and everything like that, long before it went. So this was drilled into you day after day. You did this training, and you're going around Fort Goma, dropping the machine into this culvert where it should be, and then retrieving them and doing it all over again. So that when it comes to the actual day, it was in your mind, it was just automatic.
How do you spell Goma?
G-O-M-E-R.
And how far in was the culvert which you had to deal with?
The actual one from the beach, let's see, 600-700 yards from the beach, roughly. Maybe a little further. I don't think so. I think it would be probably about 600-700 yards.
Can you tell me precisely what your instructions were once you landed? What were you supposed to do?
Well, when we went across on D-Day, we were supposed to land 5th of June, actually. D-Day was supposed to be the 5th of June. And we sailed down past the Isle of Wight the day before. But we got called back because the sea was a bit rough. And then we went across for June the 6th. And when we got near France, I mean, the waves were so high, I think everybody would have fought to get off the landing craft. And they were saying it was the worst that the channel had ever been. And when we sailed in, HMS Roberts was firing above us. And when she opened up the boats, you know, the flat bottom boats, we were just lifting up and down off them, off the landing craft. And my job was to get in. When we landed, we went through the gaps of the trestles of the barbed wire and the landmine, the mines and things like that. We had to go through them and drive through them on the beach. And my orders were to get to this particular culvert, drop the bassine in, drive over the top of the bassine, go to the crossroads and hold the crossroads until the rest of the tanks came up and the rest of the infantry came through.
Which beach were you supposed to land on?
Gold Beach. I think. I was pretty certain it was Gold Beach.
Now, going back to Fort Goma, You're in this concentration area. Can you tell me what happened to you there?
Well, we had the Winnipeg Rifles. We were stationed with the Canadians because we were going in with the Canadian Army. There was the Winnipeg Rifles and I forget what they call the other two. There's another two lots, but there were half Apaches, I think, the Winnipeg Rifles. And we took our turns for going for meals because it was the Army. Their camp was so big. But we did quite a bit of training there, and we got bombed a couple of times while we were there, And we had quite a few bits of shrapnel flying around because we were all under canvas. Well, I'm saying under canvas, we were under the tank sheets, lying beside the tank. So, as I say, we'd just been training there mainly, ready for D-Day, and did the actual thing that was going to happen. And we had to seal the tanks there. Every tank had to be sealed to keep the water out, in case which we were dropped into 6 foot of water when we got to France. Supposed to be 6 foot, but we dropped in deeper water than that.
How did you do the sealing yourself?
We all did. Each crew did its own tank.
How did you do it?
This black compound that we had to go right round all underneath the tanks and seal all the joints of all the tanks, and this compound sealed in it dried into a very hard sealing, and the exhaust, we had to put extended exhausts on, and you put extended air louvers on the sides of the tank, so that there's no water got into the air louvers or the exhaust, and I think it was about 4 or 5 foot above the tank, these extras was on, so that you could get through the water. And then when you got off the other side, that would be blown off, so that you're back to normal.
Blown off how?
There was a small explosive charge, and it was all coupled to the turret. And the tank commander just pressed this button and blew these things off. The air louvers, some of the air louvers, they were supposed to be left there until you got decent distance in, and then take them off yourself. Some of them had the explosive charge, which I always had. Blow them off as soon as we got out to the beach.
How difficult was it to do the sealing? Was it a fiddly job?
It was, because you had to go around, seal it, and then it was taken down as what we called the wash. We were going down into drive down into a wash which was away from the camp, put the tank into there and let it stand and sit in it and see if there's any water came in, just to check it out. And if it was, well, you had to come back and start all over again, and especially where the water was coming in. And you had to take it into to a depth, more or less, to make sure the water wasn't coming around the rings as well, and so that every part of the tank was sealed. And being as you're responsible yourself, you made sure it was definitely sealed, because if you're going to go into the sea, you didn't want any water coming in when you got the other side. Which is, I think, was a good thing to do, because you're doing it for yourself. You knew you were responsible for yourself.
Did the water come in when yours was tested in the water tank?
The first time there was a little bit of water, just seeped in a little bit. Not much, but it did seep in. So we had to come back and scrape and do everything again, make sure. Then it was taken back to try again, and then we were all right.
Was the sealant messy and smelly?
Wasn't smelly, it was messy. You were up to the eyes, you know, hands and everything was all thick black, like a tar, which was difficult to get off after we finished. But some parts of it you could use a scraper or a bit of stick or something to put it on with, but a lot of it to make sure you had to get your hands into it, to make sure everything was sealed, get into all the fine cracks and things like that. You discovered cracks you thought wasn't there.
And what about your tank crew? Can you tell me about them and what ranks they had?
Yes, I had a very good crew. I think I had one of the best crews in the squadron. Jim Ashton was the tank commander, who was a lance sergeant. Bill Hawkins was a lance corporal. He was the explosive expert. Roy Manley was a sapper. He was the radio operator and cook, as I said before. Batson, Ron Batson, he was a gunner. The only one I can't tell you about, and it's a funny way this happened, was my co-driver. Because when we were getting ready for the go on D-Day, the day before we sailed, my actual co-driver went down with appendicitis. So that rushes another co-driver in. And we didn't get much chance to get another lad, unfortunately. Because when she got on board, everybody got out of the tanks, you know, and you know, you spoke to them, you talked to them, but you didn't get much chance to get to know the lad properly. And then when we got hit afterwards, that's the only one that neither Bill Hawkins or I could remember his name. We could remember all the others, but couldn't remember him at all, because he's, as I say, came in as an emergency replacement. But I think we have some ideas, but we're not sure.
What rank did you hold?
I was just driving mechanic.
How do you think everybody felt before D-Day about the events? Were people fearful or excited or looking forward to it, or what?
I think everyone was excited, but I think the nerves took over as much as anything. I think everybody was a bit nervous. They all had the same idea, well, it's a job we've got to do, and the sooner we get over, the better. But at the same time, I think we're all a bit tense. It took a while for to get yourself sorted out, and after we did the training in Fort Gomer, I think we were all a bit more confident and a bit more relaxed. Going across on the ship, I think everybody was seasick, you know, on the landing craft. I think everybody was seasick, especially with the landing craft being flat-bottomed. You know, you go up on the waves and it was just slapping down. I think everybody was seasick going. Until we got the order to mount up. And I think everything just left us then, and we went, you're calm enough, you know, to land.
But did anybody think, oh, well, I'm not going to come back, or I'm going to be maimed, or something like that?
Funny you said that. I mean, we were told not to expect come back. When we first started the training in Fort Gomer, they told that a lot of us wouldn't be coming back, and not to expect too much, because I don't know whether the high-ups thought it was going to be another day up or not, whether they had confidence it was going to go the way it did. But I think our CEO, the lad, man we had at that particular time, because he left us before we went across India, I don't know whether he had the idea that a lot of us was going to get wiped out or not, I don't know. But we were told not to expect too much and not to expect come back some of us.
Who told you?
The CEO.
Was he a colonel?
Yeah.
You said your squadron. Do you remember which squadron you belonged to?
2-6 Assault Squadron, Royal Engineers.
And which subunit of that squadron did you
belong? I was in C. Our troop was C Troop.
Did your tank have a name or number?
Just C for Charlie. That's all we. Recognition sign was on the side, C, for your radio. I think C for Charlie for our troop.
And who was controlling your tank?
Jim Ashton. And then we had Captain Hewitt, who had the command of the troop. He was commander of the troop itself. 6 tanks.
What rank did Ashton hold?
Jim Ashton was a staff sergeant, Lance Sergeant.
And where was he?
He was my tank commander, Jim. But Hewitt, Captain Hewitt, he was in charge of my troop. He was back on the beach when we lost the tank, and he came up behind us afterwards.
Now, going back to Fort Gomer, where the